Everybody wants to know, how much Bitcoin do I actually need to retire? There's a massive debate. Is it one Bitcoin? Is it 10 Bitcoin? Can you retire on as little as 0.1 Bitcoin? When better money comes along, it completely obsoletes prior money. And if you just look at all the money in the world, you divide it by 21 million, you're looking at a $47 million per coin Bitcoin price tag. I think things are gonna get even more bullish than that. Again, I could very comfortably walk you through the maths of why one Bitcoin could actually be worth hundreds of millions of dollars per coin in today's purchasing power. Because it's so difficult to retire with dollars. Think about it, 10 years ago, everybody was like, I want to be a millionaire. When I grow up, I think I can become a millionaire and that will be the retirement level. What's changed in the past 10 years? Well, right now, $1 million can't even buy you a shoebox apartment in Toronto, Vancouver, London, Sydney, Melbourne, LA, all of these big mega cities that we're told, go and retire there because life is better in the West. And all you needed was $1 million. It's impossible to retire because you never know how much of that pie you own. You think you've got $1 million and you've got a sliver of that pie, and then all of a sudden the pie grows by 40% the next year, and your little sliver stays the same. Bitcoin is very different because there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin that we'll ever create and ever circulate. I believe we're all looking at adoption wrong. The way we should be looking at adoption is what percentage of the billionaires, the nation states, the sovereign wealth funds and the hedge funds are adopting Bitcoin. And I believe they're adopting Bitcoin at a far more rapid rate than the retail plebs are. That's what TradFi thinks, and I think TradFi doesn't understand anything, let alone money and finance. They are now saying that if you don't have a 10% Bitcoin allocation, you're getting significantly left behind. So Zuckerberg is the only person, the only CEO of a public company, hypothetically, who could buy more Bitcoin than Michael Saylor today.
Bing bong, we are live here in Medellin, Colombia, where I'm here with the scumbag again, Luke Mikic, who's peacocking around in these red light glasses. Who is this guy? Who does he think he is? But Luke, we've been talking a lot here lately about how much Bitcoin you need to retire. Now, I don't know if you really know that answer, man. So tell me, what are you thinking on how much Bitcoin you need to be financially free, to retire, to live a good, prosperous life here in the future?
I'm thinking that you're jealous of these big red light blocking glasses.
But I think Bitcoin, retiring on Bitcoin, it's such an interesting topic in all seriousness.
Everybody wants to know, how much Bitcoin do I actually need to retire? There's a massive debate. Is it one Bitcoin? Is it 10 Bitcoin? Can you retire on as little as 0.1 Bitcoin? I think it's something that's really captured the cultural zeitgeist. And everybody in Bitcoin is talking about it because it's so difficult to retire with dollars. Think about it. 10 years ago, everybody was like, I want to be a millionaire. When I grow up, I think I can become a millionaire and that will be the retirement level. What's changed in the past 10 years? Well, right now, $1 million can't even buy you a shoebox apartment in Toronto, Vancouver, London, Sydney, Melbourne, LA, all of these big mega cities that we're told, go and retire there because life is better in the West. Life is better in these large democratic countries and all you needed was $1 million. All of a sudden, if I go and buy a home in LA for $1 million, I'm going to have a 2-bedroom, 100-square-foot closet where I can't even fit my gay uncle, hide him in the closet, and I certainly can't retire because I'll probably get stabbed when I walk out on the front street, right? All of a sudden, $1 million does not buy you what it used to buy you, okay? The great American dream is over. It died 10 years ago. I actually believe it died 16 years ago, if my math serves me correctly. Actually, 17 years ago, because we're now in 2025. Allow my slow brain to adjust there. We are in the second week of 2025. And 17 years ago, we saw the 2008 global financial crisis. And that was when I believe we entered this second era where people can no longer retire on fiat. They can no longer retire on dollars. And that's because we've seen tens of trillions of dollars printed all around the world since 2008. So that's, I believe, why. A little bit of backstory on why you can't retire on fiat anymore. And this is why people are beginning to think, hang on a minute, maybe we need to start thinking about these new levels of retirement. Because right now it's gone from a million to 10 million in the world of fiat. Now, if you want to retire in the greatest cities of the 20th century, London, Toronto, New York, Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, I don't think a lot of people want to retire there, let's be honest. But the game has changed in the past 17 years. It's gone from a million to 10 million. So everybody's aware that retiring in the world of fiat is getting exponentially more difficult. And this is where it gets really interesting when we start talking about Bitcoin. Because to retire in the world of fiat, people know that they're on this ever-increasing treadmill where each year they need more and more money in their retirement accounts. And that's purely because there is more and more fiat money printed all around the world. And it's really difficult to have $1 million in fiat in your superannuation account and you think that you're safe. And then in 1 year, in the space of 2 months, your government prints 40% of all of the money that's ever existed, diluting your slice of the pie. Because in 2020, there was a lot of people thinking, I've got $1 million in my 401k or my superannuation, as we call it in Australia. And a lot of people were probably thinking, I'm set. I've got my $1 million. And then all of a sudden, house prices rise by 40% in 2 years because our government just has a monopoly. They have an ability to just print as much money as they like, give it to the bankers, and they dilute the value of your savings or your retirement account. Now, this is where a little bit of, again, you opened Pandora's box when you asked me a question about retiring on Bitcoin. I can talk about this for an hour, and I apologize.
Oh, just this topic for an hour? Come on, brother. This guy blabs all day.
We've been living together for 3 weeks. I put this guy through hell. So there's a little bit of context of why everybody's really fascinated and fed up with this idea of retiring on fiat. It's impossible to retire because you never know how much of that pie you own. You think you've got $1 million and you've got a sliver of that pie, and then all of a sudden the pie grows by 40% the next year and your little sliver stays the same. Bitcoin is very different because there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin that we'll ever create and ever circulate. So we know with Bitcoin that whatever you own today, that share of the network, for example, if you own one Bitcoin today, that's 21 millionth of the entire Bitcoin network. If you own one Bitcoin today, your share is always going to stay the same because there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin, which makes the maths of figuring out how much Bitcoin you need to retire all the more easy. And it's a lot easier to wrap your head around because then the only assumption you have to make is, okay, how much do I think Bitcoin will be worth in the future? If I think Bitcoin to be worth $10 million, I've got one Bitcoin, I've got $10 million in the world of fiat. So I think this is why there's such an interesting debate surrounding retirement in the Bitcoin space, because it is completely contradictory to the world of fiat, because there are a lot less assumptions you need to make when you think about your retirement. If you get to one Bitcoin, as our friend British HODL continually encourages people to do, you know that there's only 21 million people who could do that in the world. And when you start really looking at global wealth, if you put yourself amongst a bracket where only 21 million people could be, you're incredibly wealthy. If you look at the top 21 million richest people in the world today, they're incredibly wealthy. They have $5 million, $10 million net worth. They own massive yachts, massive mansions on the beach. I think that's a better way to think about things because it could make things a little bit easier for people to conceptualize. So there's 50 million millionaires in the world today. So if you're in the top 21 million millionaires in the world today, you're doing really well for yourself. So it's a long-winded answer talking about how much Bitcoin you need to retire, but I think it's a topic that doesn't get enough attention because it is such an important topic to talk about. And we can dive a lot deeper on this and talk about more numbers and run a little bit of quick maths, as you like to do.
This guy, the probabilities. This guy, he loves to hit the Trump hands when he talks about the probabilities, too.
Oh, my, yeah.
Watch out. He'll start talking with his hands. But it's on the top of my mind because I just talked with Jeff Booth a little bit about this. And he was saying, in today's purchasing power, one Bitcoin is worth $47 million. Mm. Now, obviously, it's 0.1 million of a dollar or 0.1 million dollars right now at 100,000 just about as we're recording this. So if it's in $47 million worth of purchasing power, if we were to get into hyper Bitcoinized world, then one Bitcoin seems like it would do pretty well. So you didn't give me a number here, Luke. I have to put you on the spot. Give it to me, man. Come on, man.
That was a slight bit of self-restraint on my behalf. Because I'm pretty sure I just talked for 15 minutes. I could talk for another 15. So now let's get into the specifics. We've given a lot of context about why retiring on fiat and Bitcoin is very different. Let's talk about numbers. Now, I love Jeff Booth's number, $47 million a coin, for multiple reasons. The first being that that implies there's still a 470x left in Bitcoin. Again, I'm sick. That math could be wrong, but I believe it's correct. A lot of people are asking themselves, what's the next 100x altcoin? Should I go buy some Dogecoin? Should I go buy some Fartcoin? Should I go buy some... I'm going to be careful what I say so we don't get this interview deleted. But people are asking themselves, why buy Bitcoin? It's too late to buy Bitcoin. You can't retire on Bitcoin. The best returns of Bitcoin are behind Bitcoin. And this is why we see tens of millions, hundreds of millions of gamblers in the Bitcoin space. There's 680 million crypto users in total as of late 2024. Think about that, 680 million. A lot of people, right? How many Bitcoin maximalists are amongst that 680 million? I'd say it's less than half. Based on on-chain data, there's about 80 million on-chain users. Bitcoiners who hold their own keys.
So do you think it's even close to half? I think it's significantly less than half, if I'm being honest. I would say, I would be surprised if it's even 10% Bitcoin maximalist.
I agree. So 80 million people who hold Bitcoin on chain, that would be 0.1% of the world holds Bitcoin in their own wallet off an exchange. If we look at total quote unquote crypto adoption, we got 680 million global users of crypto, people who think they own Bitcoin, they don't, they're touching shitcoins. That's still less than 1% adoption. So the reason why I go through all of these numbers is because all of the narratives of people saying we're late to Bitcoin couldn't be further from the truth. We're at less than 1% global adoption of Bitcoin. That's based on the number of people who own Bitcoin and crypto. The Bitcoin maximalists with self-custody Bitcoin holding their own keys, 0.1%.
Peacocking around in red light glasses.
Bro,
0.01%.
I got no sats. It's the biggest sign of overcompensation.
Yeah, comes up. Oh, look at me in my tank top, my red light glasses. This is perfect, right?
No shoes on.
Yeah, I mean, who is this guy?
Love it. I love it. I'm shameless, baby. You know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Ungovernable, right?
Yeah. Ungovernable, baby. So I think the reason why I give all these percentages is because I want to paint the picture that we're incredibly early. And a lot of people hear numbers like $47 million Bitcoin, and they're like, pie in the sky, baby. But I think what people don't understand is monetary transitions are an all or nothing transition. How many people still use silver as money today?
Probably none.
Silver was the dominant money used in China only 150 years ago. China refused to adopt a gold standard 150 years ago in the late 1800s and the early 1900s when the world was on a gold standard. How many people use China for money? How many people use silver, for money in China today? 0%. How many people actually still hold gold in America today? 150 years ago, 100% of people held gold. Today, less than 1%.
And gold became illegal, I believe, like less than 100 years ago. It was probably like 70 years ago, right? And then 40s, I want to say.
1933, executive order 6102.
There we go.
So What I'm saying is when better money comes along, it completely obsoletes the prior money. So there's a very important reason why I framed that up, but there's $900 trillion of money in the world today. All Jeff Booth is saying by predicting $47 million Bitcoin?
No, he didn't even just predict that. He's just saying in today's terms, if you looked at the total monetary supply just divided by 21 million, that means single Bitcoin, 47 million.
Yep.
It's quick math, dude. It's pretty easy.
We don't even need to get complex.
Yeah.
We can just say, I just laid out an assumption saying that when better money comes along, it obsoletes prior money. So we don't even need to do all sorts of crazy maths calculations with the multiplier effect. And we don't even need to consider the fact that not all 21 million Bitcoin are available for sale. Jeff's just keeping it simple. And I think that's most digestible for the audience, really. When better money comes along, it completely obsoletes prior money. And if you just look at all the money in the world, you divide it by 21 million, you're looking at $47 million per coin Bitcoin price tag. But I think things are going to get even more bullish than that. Again, I could very comfortably walk you through the maths of why one Bitcoin could actually be worth hundreds of millions of dollars per coin in today's purchasing power. So again, when people hear $47 million Bitcoin, I think something that's completely wrong, and it's probably the first thing that goes through their head, they say, oh, but what's the dollar worth in that world? And people don't understand what Jeff and I are both saying is, no, we're talking about today's purchasing power. Because we're not assuming 100, 200, 300, 400 more trillion dollars are gonna be printed. We're saying of all the money in the world that exists today, one Bitcoin should be worth $47 million per coin, which means in today's purchasing power, you can buy $47 million worth of goods and services with one Bitcoin. Let's put some numbers behind that. So the average beachfront property in Malibu, California, this is the pristine real estate. This is the best house you could ever dream to have. I was going to say something about our windowless house that we were just staying in, but I might tease that for a future episode. What one Bitcoin will buy you in a hypothetical world where it's worth $47 million per coin, it's going to buy you nearly five of the best mansions in the best state, in the best country, in the best location to own real estate. The best real estate in the world is coastline California. Again, some people are going to say, oh, but commie California. Oh, but Democrats rule the state. I understand all of that. I escaped Australia because of all the commie bullshit, okay? But you cannot argue with the fact that real estate on the coastline in California is the best in the world. And I believe that one Bitcoin should buy you five of those mansions on the beach in California. And that's all we're really talking about when we're saying Bitcoin's purchasing power today, its fair value, is at least tens of millions of dollars per coin.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens, you flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks, 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage, and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show. Yeah, and that's coming soon, I think. You know, I mean, you mentioned it. We're sitting here as California is going through its little bit of a heat wave, to put it lightly. But, I mean, it doesn't escape the point, right? Michael Saylor always says that Bitcoin is like owning a piece of property in Manhattan, right? But they always talk about being able to go up and everything like that. Do you think that that is maybe the best example just because it's just a finite island? Like, maybe the only way you can go up in real estate? Like, why do you think people have such a hard time grasping the scarcity when it comes to Bitcoin? Is it because we've never seen anything truly scarce? I mean, is it because you only got one pair of red light glasses that only exists and Luke Mikich can peacock around in it? Like, why do you think people can't grasp the scarcity when it comes to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I short answer for this one, I just think it's because we've never seen anything like Bitcoin before. I mean, it's very common that nobody understands any new technological revolution. Nobody understood the importance of the steam engine when that was created in the early 1800s. The same with electricity 50 years later in the 1860s when Edison was doing all of that good stuff with the light bulbs that's behind us today. This is the same 50 years later when the automobile was created during the oil revolution in the early 1900s. Nobody understood what Henry Ford did. Again, there's a famous quote by Henry Ford. If I had asked the everyday person what they wanted, they would have told me a faster horse. The everyday person doesn't understand technology. And we've known that for hundreds of years. And I think it's the same with the internet today. How many people actually understand how the different layers of the TCP/IP protocol stack actually work? I don't. I don't even know if TCP/IP is correct. Couldn't tell you.
Probably not. if history says anything. But I mean, you talked about internet and a lot of these other adoption curves. If you look at the adoption curve of Bitcoin right now, it's bounds faster than the internet already. But it seems like we're saying here, we're still so early. Like, people just don't understand. But the adoption curve is faster than the internet. So are we just on the fastest horse that we've ever seen come about here with Bitcoin and Bitcoin adoption?
Yeah, so I've got really different views on Bitcoin adoption curves. I'm going to try not to open Pandora's box again, but I believe everybody's looking at Bitcoin adoption curves wrong. I believe everybody's looking at Bitcoin adoption based upon how many people are using it as a medium of exchange. So this is where everybody's saying, Bitcoin adoption, what's Bitcoin adoption? Bitcoin isn't being adopted because my Uncle Bob or my Aunt Millie, they aren't using Bitcoin to buy a coffee. Bitcoin's not being adopted by the masses or my people in my friend group. And that's fair. And I can recognize that. And I believe the way we should be thinking about Bitcoin adoption is I believe there's two adoption curves for Bitcoin. There's Bitcoin, the adoption curve of it being used as a medium of exchange. And I believe this adoption curve is going to take a much longer time to happen. And that is because the masses, the retail people, Uncle Bob and Aunt Millie, it's going to take them a long time to adopt a new technology, because that's what happens every single time. New technological revolutions are not driven by the everyday Joe or the everyday Bob. They're driven by the revolutionaries. Now, this gets me into the second adoption curve that I think is the one that matters the most, and I think that's going to happen much quicker than Bitcoin, the medium of exchange. This is Bitcoin, the store of value asset. Now, the way to measure this adoption curve is by looking at how much of the $900 trillion of assets is actually flowing into Bitcoin. And more importantly, what percentage of the people who have the most say over that $900 trillion of assets, what are they doing? Are they adopting Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin's a store of value asset, and it's going to take over the world. It is going to suck in hundreds of trillions of dollars of capital, even if you're conservative. The most conservative Bitcoiners say that it's going to be worth at least gold. It's going to be worth at least gold's market cap. So it's going to be worth at least $20, $30, $40 trillion a coin. So tens of trillions, if not hundreds of trillions, are coming, if not more. So I believe the way we should be looking at adoption curves is, okay, who is actually responsible for the majority of that $900 trillion of assets? Sovereign wealth funds hold $60 trillion of assets. Asset managers like BlackRock, Vanguard, VanEck, They hold over $50 trillion of assets. Nation states who are squatting on around $100 trillion of government debt. These are all the people that we need to be watching. And we need to be watching at what kind of pace and rate are they adopting Bitcoin. Because these guys matter more than the retail guys. In total, what is it in America? The top 1% owns like 50% of the assets?
Yeah, and I think BlackRock owns what? How much of the percentage of the S&P 500 companies? Like they own like over half, I believe, right?
Yeah, so we need to be watching what they do with their money. This is why I believe that it's a bad idea to just measure Bitcoin's adoption based upon how many people are using it as a medium of exchange, because they don't matter. The retail guys, I consider myself lower and probably middle class, let's be honest, but we don't matter. Us with our 0.1 Bitcoin or 1 Bitcoin, we don't matter. We don't move the needle because globally, collectively, out of that $900 trillion of assets, the lower and the middle class might only control, you know, 5 or 10 trillion. So why is everybody so obsessed by looking at what we're doing? Why is everybody measuring Bitcoin adoption based on a tiny sliver of global assets and what they're doing? The real people who are going to move the needle are the guys who control $50 trillion of assets. The asset managers, the sovereign wealth funds, the nation states, the pension funds. Those are the people who matter. And what I think is really interesting is we're watching them adopt Bitcoin at an exponentially increasing rate. So the hedge funds, for example, there is 15,000 hedge funds around the world. They control over $5 trillion of assets. What if I told you that over 65% of the largest hedge funds around the world owned Bitcoin? What if I told you that overall, 47% of all of those hedge funds own Bitcoin? So when we start talking about these numbers, things get more funky and they get more interesting because the big boys are already well into Bitcoin. Of the largest sovereign wealth funds around the world, 6 out of the 10 largest sovereign wealth funds own Bitcoin. Qatar, UAE has a couple of the largest sovereign wealth funds. They all own Bitcoin. And then this is a $50 trillion segment. This is a $50 trillion market, the sovereign wealth funds. Same thing when we look at pension funds. Pension funds are buying Bitcoin hand over fist. And it's the same thing with nation states. Since Trump said we want to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve for the country.
The quick maths here. The quick maths here for the quick maths for Luke. I can't wait till he starts doing that with his hands, dude.
Just wait. There's gonna be more of these, baby. The final point I was gonna make was nation states. Since Trump was elected, we've seen over 25 different regions around the world say that they're going to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve in 2025. So I believe we're all looking at adoption wrong. The way we should be looking at adoption is what percentage of the billionaires, the nation states, the sovereign wealth funds, and the hedge funds are adopting Bitcoin. And I believe they're adopting Bitcoin at a far more rapid rate than the retail plebs are. And I think these are the guys who matter. It's those who control the majority of the $900 trillion of global assets. They are going to be the ones that drive Bitcoin adoption. And this is my biggest gripe with most people in this space. People can only think in these linear lenses, and they're saying what happened over the past 15 years, it's what's going to happen in the next 15 years. And I believe they're not looking at the data.
Of course you don't, dude, because you got the red light lenses on, dude, the exponential lenses here. All these other people are looking in through their linear lenses, just the normal, like, you know, sunglasses or glasses, whatever they are, dude. They don't have these red light exponential lenses that Luke Mitch is. Yeah, I mean, I might have to at this point to see what you're seeing. But, you know, with that, right, you're talking about all these institutional investors getting in, right? If you look at the narrative through like some of these other institutional investors like VanEck, for example, they say a lot of these guys, they're not giving their clients advice to buy Bitcoin. They're saying keep it at a very small percentage. They're saying although all these people might be, you know, necessarily all these hedge funds might be buying Bitcoin. They're not full-fledged into it. They're not full-fledged maxis. Now, what's it going to take for them to start to become these full-fledged maxis, Luke? And then what happens when that game theory starts playing out? Are we going to be in that gradually then suddenly here where we're going to see things start to blow the top off? Because as Jeff Booth put it, right, in today's purchasing power, Bitcoin should be worth $47 million if it is what – if everybody saw what we're seeing. So that means we would have a 470x to where we're at today, which would see things getting a little crazier than what we're at right now, Luke. So what's it going to take? Do people just have to wake up? Do they need to put on these exponential red light glasses or what, man?
I'd give them to them. I can have them. I'm going to get blinded with these lights in here.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty. But simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Honestly, though, all it's going to take is time. That's it. And people are like, no, but Bitcoin needs all of this education and adoption and all of these initiatives. It needs Larry Fink to shill our bags. As Eric Balkunas would say, oh, Bitcoin would be dead without the ETFs. Bitcoiners should be getting on their knees and thanking BlackRock and Larry Fink for saving our bags. That's what TradFi thinks. And I think TradFi doesn't understand anything, let alone money and finance. Probably a rabbit hole for another day we can explore. But what I will say is that all we need is time. Because when a better technology is invented, everybody adopts it. It's a matter of survival. And 3 years ago, Larry Fink was saying that Bitcoin's only use case is money laundering. It's an index of money laundering. Bitcoin's a shitcoin. Larry Fink and the world's largest asset managers, they were saying, we don't care about Bitcoin. We think Bitcoin's trash. We think that you should hold cash and treasuries and government bonds, right? That's what the narrative was only 3 years ago. What's changed in 3 years? Well, at the beginning of 2024, Larry Fink, the world's largest asset manager, said, yeah, I was wrong. I was an idiot. I didn't understand money. I didn't understand finance. We're now going to launch a Bitcoin ETF. 12 months later, most people thought he was a clown. Most people thought he was just looking for the next ESG to pump his bags. And now 60, 70% of the world's largest asset managers, again, as we said earlier, a $50 trillion market is buying Bitcoin. And now what we're seeing is we're seeing interviews hosted on Charles Schwab, a multi-trillion dollar asset manager, where they are openly welcoming analysts to go on their program at Charles Schwab and say that if you don't have a 10% Bitcoin allocation, at least you are going to get left behind. Direct quote. So, long answer again, but I hope I painted the picture there. All we need is time. Bitcoin's gone from a joke, it's money laundering in 2021, Larry Fink. No, in 2022. Larry Fink was saying Bitcoin's a joke, it's anti-ESG, it's money laundering. 2 years pass? Okay, I was wrong. I'm going to launch this Bitcoin ETF thing here. 6 months later, Bitcoin is hope. Larry Fink is saying Bitcoin is digitizing gold. Larry Fink is saying that Bitcoin's an international legitimate asset. 6 months later, multi-trillion dollar asset managers. The biggest swinging chads that there is, right? If this is a measuring contest, BlackRock and Charles Schwab are the biggest swingers in that measuring contest. They are now saying that if you don't have a 10% Bitcoin allocation, you're getting significantly left behind. So all we need is time. In 2 years' time, it's going to be a 50% Bitcoin allocation. And again, this is just the data. This is just the data.
Show me the data, Luke. Show me the data, dude. I mean, all right, you said TradFi doesn't understand Bitcoin and doesn't understand how finance work, but do you think they understand how good haircuts and style work if you're coming in here looking like this, man, with that lesbian haircut you got going on? But all right, you brought up Larry Fink, right? How 2 years ago he was, you know, yelling from the rooftops, Bitcoin's for money launderers. We had just the other week Jamie Dimon doing the same thing, saying Bitcoin for money launderers. Then a report from JP Morgan saying, hey, just hold 1%, you know, maybe in this diversified crypto bag. And that, you know, just a mere couple years ago that they said, hey, if you let your clients start to hold Bitcoin, that's going to open up this can of worms that would create this massive amount of degeneracy. So although Larry Fink has been coming around to this, it seems like still TradFi is teetering on the edge here, Luke. So, you know, although these big money managers, some of them are coming along, some of them are still being left behind here. So where do you think it's at with traditional financial institutions? Do you think we're all the way there yet? Do you think Jamie Dimon is just blowing hot air in a microphone like we're doing here and lying to us, even though JP Morgan's slowly buying Bitcoin? Where do you think it's at?
What I will say is one of us is probably blowing more hot air than the other.
Yeah, and he's sitting across the table from me.
You got me there. What I will say is that I really do think that you have to watch what people are doing and not what they're saying. I want to come back to the data here shortly and really start. I love talking about the data, you know that, and why most of the data in the Bitcoin space is trash, in particular these models. But what I will say is you have to watch what people are doing, not what they're saying. We've done videos on JP Morgan, and two of the really interesting bullish reports they've written about Bitcoin in the past 30 days alone, in December. They're openly saying Bitcoin and gold are permanent parts of portfolios. And they're saying that Bitcoin is a hedge. Okay, so I think, and Jamie Dimon has been doing this for a very long time. Way back in 2017, there's a really viral clip of Jamie Dimon being exposed in 2017 for announcing that he's going to fire anybody who works at JP Morgan, any of his employees, if they're caught buying Bitcoin. And then at the same time, oh, hang on a minute. Uncle Jamie's doing some pretty interesting things in the background that's actually bullish and openly buying Bitcoin. So he's fraudulent. He's a liar. Again, why is JP Morgan publishing two bullish Bitcoin reports in the past 30 days, but then big old Jamie's wheeled out on national television and he's bashing Bitcoin? It's always watch what they're doing, not what they're saying, because those reports wouldn't have been published at JP Morgan if he was not okay with them. He's just a mouthpiece. He's just, honestly, just a guy that most people shouldn't pay attention to. And I think the biggest point that proves that is, guess who he banked? Jeffrey Epstein. Jamie Dimon is Jeffrey Epstein's banker. Why do I care what Jamie Dimon has to say?
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, he is influential, right? I mean, like, people still look to him at traditional media. And hell, in that interview where he said, you know, that Bitcoin is for sex trafficking and all these different things, they actually said, hey, but you're the CEO of the world's largest bank. Your opinion matters. They literally said that right before that question. Self-custody can be a daunting task. That's why I've partnered with Bitbox. They have the best hardware wallet. They make it the easiest to put Bitcoin in self-custody. So go to bitbox.swiss/greencandle today and use promo code greencandle and you can get 5% off your entire order. They make it so easy, all in one. You could get the hardware wallet, you could get their punch plates, you could do it all right there on that website to make the self-custody experience the easiest it can be. So visit bitbox.swiss/greencandle. Use promo code greencandle, get 5% off your entire order. And get your Bitcoin off an exchange into self-custody today. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
How does Jamie know that Bitcoin's used for sex trafficking? Because his biggest client's Jeffrey Epstein. That's how he knows it.
Woo-wee! There we go, Luke. So, wait, are you telling me that you went to Epstein Island? And I haven't seen you in the same room over there, Luke.
Oh, no, that bright.
you won't catch me over there, yeah. Dog.
Exactly. But, I mean, I think it's interesting that, we're seeing the kind of dichotomy here, right? Where it's watch what they do, not what they say, right? Yeah, I know you stole that phrase from me. We've been living in the same house for 3 weeks. I mean, you could give me credit for all your great ideas. I mean, if you want to do it here live on the podcast, I'd be more than happy to take all credit right here.
But
anyway, with all this being said, why do you think that he feels the need to do that and be the public mouthpiece blowing this hot air in front of everybody and in traditional media, nonetheless, where he's getting these softball questions being lobbed up to him where he could just smack them out? They're like, oh, Jamie, everybody cares so much what you're saying, all this and that. And then they're asking him these things and they're just letting him run his hot mouth, saying all these wild things. Why do you think he still feels the need to do that when Bitcoin is so obviously winning? He's been talking about it since 2017. He's seen over 10x returns if you would have just bought Bitcoin at that point in time. So why do you think he feels the need to do that?
To be entirely honest, dude, I've had nothing but strong opinions until now, and I just don't have a strong opinion. I don't know why Jamie's doing what he's doing. I couldn't give you a good answer for that. All I will say is just I would encourage people to just watch what they're doing, not what they're saying. And what I will say is something that I feel relatively strongly about is over the past 3 or 4 years, I do believe we've been in a concerted effort to suppress the price of Bitcoin, whether that was China banning Bitcoin mining in March 2021, whether that was Elon Musk coincidentally doing a little bit of a Bitcoin backflip weeks after China banned Bitcoin mining in 2021, whether that was SBF, everybody's favorite autist with the long curly hair, openly suppressing the price of Bitcoin under $20,000, which is what we found from the transcripts of the private phone calls between him and his girlfriend, Caroline Ellison. SBF had her on the phone saying, actively sell Bitcoin every single time it's above $20,000. SBF was the largest donor to the Democratic Party in America, I believe. And all of this was happening in a 12-month window when Bitcoin ran from $10,000 to $65,000. It had one of its fastest parabolic rises ever. And you see China, Elon, SBF get spun up into notoriety. You also see another coordinated attack between the World Economic Forum and BlackRock promoting this ESG agenda, saying that Bitcoin is not ESG friendly. Proof of work mining is boiling the oceans. We need to adopt proof of stake. Those are 5 different data points that all coincidentally pop up within 12 months of each other as the price of Bitcoin is aggressively running from 10,000 to 65,000. And this was the first time ever that Bitcoin was noticed by the largest capital allocators around the world. It's been my thesis since mid-2020 that Bitcoin entered a new era in 2020. And my thesis is pre-2020, 99% of the trading volume was done by retail speculators. And there was no nation states, no pension funds, no Michael Saylors, no public companies, no nation states. I said nation states twice. But none of the big money was buying Bitcoin pre-2020. Post-2020, I believe 99% of the trading volume is now being dominated by the big money. So I think it's coincidental that Bitcoin's first parabolic increase, where it went from 10K to 65K in 4 to 5 months in late 2020, early 2021, was met by what looks to be a coincidental chronological timeline of events of some of the largest, let's call them influencers in finance, all deciding to attack Bitcoin. So I believe the price has been suppressed. Been saying that for years, been banging the drum about that one for years and years. And I believe Jamie's opinions is probably just, maybe he's trying to help his Wall Street buddies accumulate more Bitcoin at prices under $100,000, because it's pretty clear. Somebody's just scooped 1 million Bitcoin, taken them off exchanges since 2020, since we entered this new era of Bitcoin. Again, before 2020, Bitcoin were only put onto exchanges. The number of Bitcoin on exchanges only rose. It went from 0 to 3.1 million. between 2008 and 2020, era number one for Bitcoin. Since 2020, the data is clear. The data is very clear that we've had around 1 million Bitcoin leave the exchanges. 30 to 35% of all the Bitcoin on exchanges has left the exchanges. And this has happened all at the same time that we've seen the backflips of BlackRock. We've seen the nation states scramble to accumulate. We've seen nations like the Kingdom of Bhutan being exposed for buying Bitcoin as early as 2019. Again, it's very close to that 2020 inflection point that I believe was reached 5 years ago now. So I believe it's very clear we're in an era of nation state accumulation, big bank accumulation. Four of the largest six banks in America own Bitcoin, have it on its balance sheet. And I believe if I had to speculate, again, not a strong opinion. I do have a strong opinion that the Bitcoin price has been suppressed aggressively, and it has been over the past 3 years. But to answer your question in a long roundabout way, I don't know what Jamie's doing. If I had to guess and really throw a dart at a dartboard, I'd say he's just trying to suppress the price of Bitcoin.
Now, you mentioned banks, you mentioned nation states. You didn't talk about corporations here, Luke. So I want to talk about the new lizard boy who's got two goats named Bitcoin and Maxi over here. Because I've got this crazy theory here, Luke, that Meta and Mark Zuckerberg could be bigger and more influential in the Bitcoin space than Michael Saylor. Granted, Michael Saylor, you met him in that stained shirt that you famously wear. You maybe shrunk it a couple sizes. Maybe you had the Bitcoin miners in the background running on extra heat to get that extra schmedium so you look a little bit bigger. But anyway, Lizard Boy, Mark Zuckerberg, potentially could be bigger and more influential than Michael Saylor. Okay, before you turn off this show here, let me line out the theory, because outside of MicroStrategy, Meta and Mark Zuckerberg, he's the only tech CEO that has more voting power than Michael Saylor did with MicroStrategy than when he started this Bitcoin policy, doing the MicroStrategy famous flywheel that we both love to talk about. Now, he could potentially do this with Meta, and the shareholders actually brought it up, where they're now asking Meta to explore this Bitcoin policy. Now, do you think I'm absolutely crazy that I'm saying that Mark Zuckerberg can be bigger than your boy, Michael Saylor, who you met in that stained shirt, and he didn't walk out of that room? I'm surprised. If I would have saw you coming in with this haircut, that shirt, I would have got out of there quickly.
I wouldn't blame him either. Yeah. They were actually in the days I was cutting my own hair as well, so it's even worse than it is today.
Exactly.
My favorite thing about Bitcoin is meeting Bitcoiners in person. That's why I am so excited to tell you guys about what is going on June 14th down in beautiful Tampa Bay, Florida. That's the Sound Money Soiree paired with Bitcoin Day. They're bringing a full day of great talks with amazing speakers like your boy here. And we're topping it off with a Black Tie event just for you and bringing that hot lady friend. We had Bitcoin cross 100K. We're all getting girlfriends, folks. So come on down to beautiful Tampa, Florida. And if you use the link below, you will get 10% off your entire order, whether you want to go to just the Black Tie event or Black Tie event plus Bitcoin Day, you'll get 10% off using the links below. Also, if you're thinking about going to BitBlock Boom in April, if you're going to Vegas in May, or if you're thinking about going to Prague in June, use my promo code GreenCandle for all of those. You'll get 10% off your entire order. And come bug me. I hope to see you guys very soon at one of these great in-person events. Enough of me. Back to the show.
So, I mean, yes, I had the pleasure of meeting Michael. I do think he's Bitcoin's most influential spokesperson today. I do think he's created the famous flywheel. I believe you just coined that term, the famous flywheel.
There we go.
He coined the term in our interview at BTC Prague. He was the first time I'd ever heard him say the infinite money glitch. And now everybody's talking about MicroStrategy and their infinite money glitch and how it increased his company's value from $1 billion in 2020 to now being worth over $90 billion 5 years later. The fastest growth in any public company's market cap in history. But he's done more than that. His infinite money glitch has also propelled MicroStrategy's treasury to be the seventh largest in the entire world. So this is important to know if I'm going to answer the question. Can Zuckerberg be more influential than Saylor? Now, this is interesting because of these six companies that have a bigger treasury than MicroStrategies, Facebook...
How long of a pause did he swallow his gum or what, dude? What is this guy doing over here?
He's trying not to burp for the past 10 minutes. Facebook is the only company that can buy more Bitcoin than Michael Saylor, and that's because of what you just said earlier. Of the six companies that have a bigger treasury than the GigaChad, Saylor, squatting on 50 to 60, 70, $44 billion worth of Bitcoin right now at the time of recording, Zuckerberg has a controlling voting power over Meta's treasury, which from memory is something like $88 billion at the time of recording. So Zuckerberg is the only person, the only CEO of a public company, hypothetically, who could buy more Bitcoin than Michael Saylor today if he makes the big GigaChad move of putting Meta's entire treasury into Bitcoin today. And he's the only one who can do that. Do I think it's likely? No. Do I think there's a 1% probability that Facebook holds more Bitcoin than MicroStrategy in the future? I would have to say there's more than a 2% probability. I would have to say that there's a chance. I'm just winding my boy up here. He loves when I bring out the maths. If I had to put a probability on it, I would have to say that there's maybe a 2 to 5% probability that Facebook has a bigger Bitcoin treasury than Michael Saylor in 5 years' time. Nobody knows the future, but I think Michael has put himself into a position that's really difficult to surpass because he has 450,000 Bitcoin at the time of recording. That's more than 2% of the entire Bitcoin supply. If another multi-trillion dollar giant like Zuckerberg wanted to enter the market and actually listen to his shareholders who are demanding that they put Bitcoin on the treasury, for him to be able to accumulate over 450,000 Bitcoin at today's prices, that kind of a whale in a market could not, absolutely could not buy more Bitcoin than Michael Saylor without significantly affecting the market price. And that's why I think Michael has that first mover advantage. That's nearly impossible to surpass. We have 2 to 2.5 million Bitcoin sitting on exchanges, depending upon how you measure it. And for one entity to quietly accumulate 450,000 Bitcoin, 20 to 25% of all of the available Bitcoin sitting on exchanges without moving the market, that would be incredible. I don't think somebody could do it.
Well, I don't think that would let our... If that were to happen, I think the market price would just move where he wouldn't be able to scoop up. No matter how much more money that Meta and the access that Meta could potentially have if they did the MicroStrategy flywheel... But I think like this whole rebranding thing would be kind of interesting. I think, you know, seeing him get the Gen Z haircut, the chain popping and everything like that. I mean, I think you could use yourself. You could take some notes from Zuck's rebranding to kind of help yourself out here, Luke. So, I mean, maybe you would become a little bit more likable then too. I mean, because, I mean, man, you really need it. But, I mean, I think it's an interesting thought experiment that we can play here where, hey, Mark Zuckerberg's looking at all these things. He's seeing Saylor get massive popularity, at least in just this micro niche of the Bitcoin space. Mm. So I think it's something that we could definitely see in the future. It's an interesting thought experiment, but I'm sick of sitting here with you for this long here, Luke, after living with you for 3 weeks. Yeah. Why don't you tell the people where they could find out more about you so they can maybe mute you on the internet or whatever. I'm kidding. You should definitely follow along to my friend here. Where can they find you, man?
No, I'd encourage them to mute as well. You want to mute? If you want to tell me I got a lesbian haircut or these sunnies are gay as AIDS, you can tell me that on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter. There's a lot of fake accounts on Twitter of me, so just follow the blue check mark one. And I'm always talking shit on YouTube, on my personal YouTube channel, and also the bitcoinnews.com YouTube channel. And with all that said, dude, I always have a blast with you. We lived together for 3 weeks and we're always throwing shit back at each other all the time. I'm always roasting Brandon for why his ID says he's 5'7", but he actually looks 5'5".
Oh, relax, dude. I did, funny story, maybe we'll tell about this one time. I did have a bouncer yell at me, said I had a fake ID because it says I'm 5'7". I should have decked him in the nose right there. Only takes 5 pounds of force to break a nose, too. Just some quick maths for you. So I probably should have done that. But you should check out Luke Mikic's Instagram, too, if you want to see him. Anytime every time he gets distracted, he's throwing out some sort of thirst trap for you. So,
You don't want to say that.
At his 98% male audience, he's trying to flex on them, all right? There's like two girls that follow him, I promise.
Maybe one.
Yeah.
I actually have tears in my eyes. I've been laughing too much.
Well, Luke, I always appreciate your time, boss, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
That was the most awkward handshake of all time, but thank you for having me, dude.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guest. Or if you're looking for more macro related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.